This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collett. Welcome to The First Time.
Catherine. Hi.
Hi, Kate.
What are we talking about today?
Today we're talking about launches.
Launches.
Yay.
Whoop.
The launch for the Helpline was about 2 weeks ago now, and life's been pretty hectic. But first, as always, let's start with skylarking. Launch day. Do you remember it?
I remember it so well because it was like a wedding or something like that.
It's so much like a wedding.
It's so much like a wedding because especially for your first book, right, it's all your people. It's not necessarily book people. They're all your...
Well, you had so many people, you had two launches.
I did have two launches. And this is hilarious because, bless her, Jessica, my publicist, was trying to prepare me that people don't get a lot of people at their launches like they say they are. And I'm like, no, Jess, I promise you, I'm going to have like 89. I've got 200 to invite. And she was like, yeah, but Kate, they won't all turn up. Anyway, I convinced her in the end that we needed to split it. I had my launch at Hill of Content in the city, which I invited like RMIT folks and publishing folks. And
I was at the Hill of Content.
You were at that, my writing nearest and dearest.
And was that the first?
That was the first one. And then a little while later, I had one in my hometown with my home bookshop, Eltham Bookshop, at my old high school, where I invited
a whole
lot of other people too. And they were huge. Like there was lots of people came. So I feel like I proved to Jessica that that I could rent a crowd. I
hope she's listening.
Yeah, I hope she's listening too. And pull them in. But it was so much fun, completely and utterly overwhelming.
Were you in the lead up to the launch? Because I was kind of, I had a lot of things booked, different things booked in, but the launch was the one thing. That was the thing I was probably most daunted.
Yeah, it's kind of scary, right? Because it's like the interface of your public-private self.
Yeah.
And it's you saying, I did this thing and I'm chucking a party for it. And if you're a person who doesn't even like your own birthday, which, you know,
most
we
of
kind
us
of
are.
Sometimes are, it's hard to go out and say, let's chuck a party for this thing that I did.
I'll ask you to come at great inconvenience.
At great inconvenience and you'll have
pressure
to buy,
you to
my,
buy
book.
My book. It's like a Tupperware party with
like a Tupperware
less
party.
Good snacks.
And then you have to remember everyone's name and sign all the books.
Oh my God, that was my
hyperventilating. I told you that part would be hard, right?
I know. It was really hard.
It's
even
really
now
hard.
I'm like, can you spell your name?
I know. You have to ask that every time. It just becomes part of the gag.
So what did you do on the day?
On the day, I was going to flying off to Byron, I think, the next day. It was the week that the book came out. And
Byron Bay Writers Festival.
Byron Bay Writers Festival, yeah. No, just for a holiday to recover. Yeah. It's kind of like that. The kids came, which was really exciting. I had a beer to settle the nerves beforehand. I had hilariously bought exactly the same dress as my best friend to wear to the event, which we'd luckily worked out the week before.
No, better to come as twins.
Bought the same one. So sorry, darling Erie. I, of course, pulled rank and got to wear the dress. And I was nervous about all the people being there and increasingly like as they all came into the room, like that moment, the wedding moment where you go, oh my gosh, those people, my writing buddies are here with like my auntie, and that kind of freaks me out. And people were so genuinely excited, and people who weren't from the book world necessarily. My gorgeous cousin Tamsin, if she's listening, bought 10 copies of the book, like
bless.
10, bought them up to have them all signed. She's probably still got some that she hasn't been able to give away yet, but I tried to ride the high of the launch, you know, for a little while after that, because it was just the most compliments or generousness I've ever had in the
it's
one city.
Amazing.
And my year 8 English teacher came, Mr. Ryan. That was pretty lovely.
Did you invite him?
I did invite him.
Oh, okay.
I did invite him. That was pretty special.
So is he still teaching English then?
No. He was like a principal, but by that stage, it was like one of the moments where you're like, I want you to like my book, please. Year 8 English teacher. So that was mine. That was my launch. Nothing will ever, ever compare to the first book launch.
Well, that's true, because I think it's also that mix of people who – there would be a lot of people there who have never been to a book launch.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So it sort of has a different vibe for that reason as well.
So tell us, what did you do on your day? Your day was absolutely launch day.
Yeah, it was. It was publication day, so it was a Monday. I was on John Fain in the morning.
You did so well. We'll put a link to that.
So that was fun. You John Fain can be a bit grumpy sometimes.
To say the least.
But he was very nice. So that was really good. And then I had a few hours before the launch, so I got my hair done. Nice. I got my hair braided.
It looked gorgeous. We'll also put photos
up. And then the launch was on at Readings in Carlton about 6 o'clock. And so my publicist, Jane, came and picked me. Jane's lovely. Came and picked me up in a cab, and we sort of arrived with plenty of time. Other people then.
Unlike people who were launching your book, for instance, who didn't arrive with much time.
Yeah, you were a bit, which is fine. I was probably more anxious about my husband, Carney.
Yes. He's
notoriously late and had been saying all day that it didn't start till 6:30. And I was saying, I'm pretty sure it starts at 6 o'clock. You have to be there at 6. So he came, yes, in a timely fashion. And he also brought the kids, and neither child had their hair brushed. You know, people were.
But they were just so completely and utterly delighted.
They were very excited to be there. And it was great. Like, to the point where I was like, what was I even worried about? It was people were so, so, so overwhelmingly, humblingly lovely. It was great.
Did you stuff up anybody's. Like writing in their book?
No writing in the book. My one regret is there was one person at Text I wanted to thank and had them written in my thing, but just,
So you went with notes, you went with a thank you.
Yep.
That you could kind of read through and progress through.
Yeah.
Would we note that there was a little bit of emotion towards the end? Was there a moment that there was a little bit of all the feelings came to the
It was just... Yeah, I guess in life people come to your wedding, they come to your funeral. A little known fact is they will also come to your book launch.
Absolutely.
I don't know if they'll come to second and subsequent book launches, but they'll definitely come to you first.
They'll definitely come to you first. Now, did you go out raging and drinking afterwards?
I would have loved to. Like, I really actually...
Not that we support that on this podcast, but...
And I'm not a huge rager, but I would have definitely done that. However, I was flying to Sydney in the morning to go on Channel 7.
Television. Subject. One has to look their best.
Yes, exactly.
And have had their sleep.
Exactly. Early flight. So on the way home, Carney and I drove back with the kids. I hadn't had dinner, so I really wanted to get hot chips. He really wanted to get ice cream. He had been doing a lot of more kid stuff than I had been of late. So he said, I like grilled. That's where I wanted to get the hot chips, because I can't eat hot chips many places because I'm silly, but I can eat them at grilled. Anyway, he went and got the ice cream by himself. I took the kids to grilled. I ate hot chips in front of them. They didn't want to eat them. And that was our beautiful post-launch. Very pragmatic. We have children celebration. It was great. I was
happy. The glamour is all gone. Well, I cannot wait till we get to discuss you and television, Catherine. I'm so excited because I, for one, jumped up and down in front of my television. But that is another story.
Stay tuned.
In this episode, we talked to Mark Brandy about fate, game shows, and writing with noise-cancelling earphones. Today I have the very great pleasure of welcoming Mark Brandy to the first time. Mark Brandy is an Australian author born in Italy. He grew up in rural Victoria. He has a degree in criminal justice and has worked as a policy advisor and project officer in the Department of Justice. His work has appeared in The Guardian, The Age and The Big Issue. His first novel, Wimmera, won the 2016 UK Crime Writers Association Debut Dagger and the 2018 Indie Book Award for Debut Fiction. Welcome, Mark.
Thanks, Kate. Thanks for having me on.
That's our pleasure. We're going to start. I know that your debut novel, Wimmera, had its genesis in a short story. Mm. Can you tell us how it became?
Yeah, geez. I'm going to go way back.
Go way back.
I think it was 2014. And I was studying in the creative writing program at RMIT. Mm-hmm. And I had this particular class, short story class, with Ania Wolowitz, who's a Polish poet.
Amazing.
She's fantastic. So and she's quite kooky. And I think she really... We had a great group in that class, a really good group of writers, and we bounced off each other. But Ania was kind of quite provocative in getting us to try new things. And I remember this one day, I don't know if it was sort of like a stream of consciousness exercise. And anyway, I wrote about a father and son on a rabbit hunting trip. And I wasn't quite sure where it came from, but I just wrote this thing out. And so I ended up with this short story, which... I then sent around to a number of journals around Australia, and everyone rejected it. No one wanted it, and as happens sometimes. And I ended up sending it off to a fairly obscure Irish literary journal, which no longer exists. I think it's called the South Circular. Sent it to them, and they decided to publish it, which was cool. And I thought that was actually one of my first published stories. And after that, I sent it off to Radio National. Actually, were doing they were running a program. It was just starting out of short stories and first person narratives. And I sent the story into them because I thought it might be a good fit. And they agreed, fortunately. And I read it out on Radio National, which was wonderful.
What was it like, that experience of reading it out on radio?
That was kind of like my first ever appearance on radio. So it was scary, but pretty magical, because you have the kind of producers there, and they, you know, really help you modulate your tone and just get that the accents right and the inflection and the pacing. So I was really nervous at first. So it took probably quite a few goes for me to get it down.
And was there something in it then, Mark, that still felt unresolved or unfinished? Like the fact that you had such success with this story, it clearly wasn't complete yet for you.
I think that's spot on. I think that what happened was once it was broadcast and I went away from it, it was still on my mind, that story, and the characters in particular, the father and son on this hunting trip. And I really, my way of dealing with that was to write more about it and to find out a little bit more about their world. And at that point, I didn't have an idea that I was going to write a novel. I didn't, and even when I came into the creative writing program, I didn't know what I was going to do. I was just enjoying writing. And it was through that process of writing more about these characters that Wimra became, in a sense. And that short story still features at the heart, I think, of the novel today. So it was really interesting. I think that, I'm not... we can probably talk about this later, but I'm not much of a planner. So you just sort of, you kind of follow your instincts with writing and where your interests lie. And that's what keeps it alive and real for me.
So there's a couple of things I want to pick up on there. First, you had a successful career in another industry, not one of writing, but you were here studying. Mm-hmm. How did that come about? What was it that just meant that you were enjoying writing?
Yeah, look, I can go way back these stories, but I always loved writing, and I always loved books. And when I came, I suppose, to like selecting a career, it was the classic thing. I was kind of, you know, migrant family, and your parents want you to have a good job. And
writing is not a good job.
No, it's a bit of a strange pursuit. So. I've got three older brothers, and all of them work, you know, for Victoria Police. So one's a forensic scientist, one's a prosecutor, one works in a covert area of Victoria Police. So when I was looking at career options, it was something legal or law related seemed the right fit. So I initially studied law and then criminal justice, and yeah, I worked in the Justice Department for about 10 years. And I suppose I really enjoyed working there, and I got to know the criminal justice system really intimately. But it kind of ran its course, and I got toward the end, what became the end, and I was kind of sick of working in an office and sick of dealing with the same issues, and I was a little bit bored by it, to be honest. And I still loved writing and was doing a little bit on the side.
In your lunch break?
Well, no, more like after hours, I would say. But nothing, you know, writing was part of my job as well. So, and I enjoyed that, you know, that craft and precision, and in terms of like writing media releases or possible parliamentary question responses and things like that. Like I enjoyed that discipline. And I think that probably is something I carried on into my writing as well. Just just that discipline of like sticking at something sometimes, even if it's hard. In terms of making the leap, there's probably a couple. Can I tell a couple of stories?
Go
about
for
that?
It.
There's one of them is like I was talking to one of my brothers about how I was having, you know, this dilemma that I was kind of sick of working in government, and he sent me a link to an online entry form for Millionaire Hot Seat. And I was like, what are you doing? And he said, no, you're like always good at trivia. This could be, you know,
your thing.
This could be your thing, and it could give you, you know, a bit of a buffer, and you could go part-time at work. And so I entered, and I ended up, I took a sickie from work.
Oh, my gosh, this is great.
And I went down. I didn't tell a soul, because I was really, the thing that terrified me was my imagination ran wild, and I thought, I'm going to end up in the hot seat for the first question. I'm going to bomb out. It's going to be something like really easy, and I'm just going to be humiliated.
How did you prepare? Had you done like some swatting for this?
I sort of did. I did like the age quiz every day for about 3 weeks. I mean, you can never know what they're going to ask.
Of course.
It's just kind of ridiculous. But just to give myself like a bit of confidence, I suppose. And I went down there to Richmond, and because it was filming there at the time, and it was the strangest experience. Have you ever been on a game show?
No, I have not, ever.
It's the weirdest thing, because it's just like, especially that one, they've got a live studio audience, they're just screaming at you, there's lights going off everywhere. Eddie McGuire's sitting there, it's so strange. And anyway, cut a long story short, I ended up in the hot seat for the last question.
Oh my God. Have you written about this?
Yeah. I've written about it, but I ended up in the hot seat, and it was a question about comic books. It was about the Green Lantern, and I read a lot of comic books when I was a kid, I'd never read the Green Lantern. Read a lot of kind of dystopian sort of 2000 AD, like UK comics that I nicked off my brothers. So I didn't know the answer, and it was like about where he derived his power, his superpower from, and I didn't know, and I just guessed, and I was lucky enough to get it right.
Oh my goodness!
And so like, it wasn't like a massive, you know, crazy amount of money, but it was enough, because it's tax free as well, and that's what I think. But people don't. That's my best advice to all writers out there.
Go on Millionaire Hot Seat.
Go on Millionaire Hot Seat. Or go on like any game show you could find.
Was the phone call to your brother after this?
I stopped around at his place, and because you're supposed to keep it confidential at that stage until it screens. But he's like, you won, didn't you? You could just see it on my face. But I really... I probably should have given him an acknowledgement in the book.
Oh my goodness. So leave your career, go on a game show, then
what's
the next step?
The next step was like I had a bike crash. That's my other bit of advice.
Right, advice to people.
Yeah. So
I had near-death experience.
Near-death experience.
Far out, Mark.
And that's the real kind of like, you know, cliche writer's epiphany. But I was hurtling down. So I'd started the writing course, and I was working part time, and that balance seemed to be working quite well for me. But then I was riding down Brunswick Street and in North Fitzroy, and I was involved in a hit run, and I ended up broke a number of ribs. I separated my collarbone from my shoulder, and had two operations, had a metal plate put in my shoulder.
Nasty.
Yeah, it was pretty bad. And like, and it was terrible, like the recovery and everything was horrible. But it did, I suppose, it did make me think, and you know, I had that kind of moment of clarity, as people say. Like, and I thought about what was important to me in life, and I thought writing is like what I really love doing. And yeah, so I quit the job altogether at that point to focus on the novel.
It is a hell of a backstory that you have. There seems to be a fair bit of tenacity as well in what you described, even in sending out that first short story that you sent it out to a number of places, then it had some success and you sent it out to more places. Mm. What was driving you there?
I suppose like you, when you start to share your work for the first time, and particularly in the confines of like workshops and classes, at first I feel like, well, I felt like I was really just testing out whether I was crazy or not, you know? Like when you first start writing, you don't really know if it's quite working. And when people were responding positively to it, I thought, I might have something here, like this, you know, could go somewhere. So I suppose it's probably partly just that feeling that there was some quality in what I was doing and a belief in that. But also, I think, an understanding that we're working in a really subjective sphere, and what someone might not like, the next person might like. And I probably had that experience early on with a couple of short stories where you would get sort of, you know, form rejections, and then others would say how much they loved it. So it's just, I don't know, I suppose it's just that kind of understanding of, like, the human condition, that we all like different things, and there is no, I think what's great about writing, or what's really alluring, is that subjectivity that's there, but it's also what's infuriating sometimes.
Yeah, and well, it seems incredible that you could so quickly take that lesson as a lesson in subjectivity and not just as one in rejection, or, you know, so many people would take just one of those and say, okay, this person doesn't like it, I'm a terrible writer. Yeah. But you were able to get past that really quickly.
Yeah, and I think that was partly, again, like because of the career that I'd worked in and working, particularly I had a stretch working in a political office, which was, I was a political advisor, and that was a really tough environment, very heated environment, a lot of pressure. You know, you didn't get praise. It was like the absence of being kind of abused, it was praise. So it was tough. And also, even like, I worked in hospitality for a long time, like pretty tough industries where like you had to build a resilience and to stick at it. And I think that sort of held me in good stead in being a writer.
Yeah, sounds like a great lesson that more of us could have.
Well, yeah, and even being the youngest of four boys, because you sort of, you're always having to, you cop a fair bit from your older brothers, so you've got to stick at things and be determined. And I think those are really good lessons that I learned early on, which I carried through to my writing.
You sent your manuscript off, so you keep writing Wimmera and you send it off to this UK award for an unpublished manuscript. Tell us about that. How did you know about that and what happened?
Yeah, well, Eva, can I backtrack just a little bit?
Go.
Because once I had the complete manuscript,
which took you how long? Sorry, I'll interrupt.
Well, it started, in about 2004. It was probably about a year and a half, 2 years, but it's kind of, I always struggle with that question because you never really, I don't know, I'm bad at keeping track of time, and you have these like bursts of intense activity and then long time not working on it. But I'd say a year and a half to 2 years. And I was lucky enough to get a fellowship at Varuna, and that was really important because that helped me refine the manuscript, but it also gave me some confidence that it was working in some way.
The validation of getting the residency or being there with the other writers?
I think of getting the residency was probably the biggest thing. And being there with other writers was great too. That was really cool. But it was more that recognition, I suppose, that, you know, up against a whole lot of other manuscripts, it was okay. And I then sent it off to Curtis Brown, the literary agency, and they took it on, which was wonderful.
They took it on straight from Varuna.
Yeah. Okay. Shortly thereafter.
So you've got an agent.
Yeah, I got an agent, and then it got sent out to a whole lot of publishers who rejected it.
So, wow.
Yeah, at that point. So that was, and that was an earlier form of the novel.
But a form that an agency had been willing to sign you on.
Yeah.
But then no publisher went for it.
No, and it was really interesting because that was, and you know, some of the answers given at the time, and I don't complain about it now, because publishing is, you know, as we know, a pretty tough industry. But some of the responses was really around how crime was situated in the marketplace at that time, and publishers kind of seeing this as being crime, but not being crime enough in some ways.
Yeah, right.
And it was really it was kind of confusing. But I still believed in it, and I reworked it and sent it out to a number of different prizes around the place. And yeah, and one of those was the Dagger in the UK. So I can't remember how I found out about it. I was always on the lookout for like unpublished manuscript prizes.
And was the agent, or was Curtis Brown still supporting you through this part, or was it like, no, okay, publishers have said no, we're done with you?
No, they were still supportive, which was okay. Great. Like it was fantastic. And they said, look, you know, let's, because I'd gotten a grant around the same time to work on my next novel.
Okay.
And so the advice was to focus on that. We'll park Wimmera for a while. We can always go back to it. But I still really believed in Wimmera. And even though I was working on the new one. They knew I was sending it out to prizes and stuff. And we were happy if it got shortlisted here and there. The Dagger was a really interesting one, because that was at the start of 2016, the entries closed for that. And I think I heard about it fairly last minute from memory. And it was literally 15 minutes before the closing time to enter. And I was sitting there going, I'm not even sure if this is a crime novel. And I really didn't, and I still don't really believe that it's a crime novel in some ways. And so I hesitated about entering, and I thought, I'll just send it. And so I sent it off. And it was probably in July that I made the long list, which was, I think, 12 from around the world. In August, I think it was, I made a short list of 5. That was great, but I think... as a result of all the rejections that I'd had along the way, I was still talking down my chances the whole way. I thought, you know, they've just put me on the short list because I'm Australian, and they're trying to make it look international. And
it's the protective thing we do, isn't it?
Well, it is. Yeah, it is that self-talk and preparing yourself for failure. And so I didn't believe I was going to win. The organisers contacted me, I think in September, and said, you know, we have this big gala dinner in London in October, and all the luminaries of publishing are there, great crime writers, we'd really love it if you came along. And I sort of thought about this, and I just thought, it's a long way to go to London. And I just imagine, like, I was still certain that I wasn't going to win. Yeah. And I thought, it's just going to be such a long flight back and just depressing. And, you know, and so I said no. So I ended up finding out that I'd won via Twitter.
Ah, Twitter. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And did the phone just immediately start ringing and, you know, offers are coming in from everywhere?
Well, yeah, I mean, things definitely changed. You know, the dynamic shifted with publishers, and publishers were, you know, contacting my agent saying they wanted, you know, was this a new version of it? They wanted to see the manuscript again. And so, and it was a new, To be fair to them, it was a new draft, so they saw the
also
new draft.
A great story in terms of your own belief in the project and the fact that you carried on that momentum to get it where it went to. So Hachette signs you, or you decide to go with them. Was it a quick process then to publication day?
Yeah, it was really, really quick because I think I signed with them in, I think it might have been October, very shortly after the Dagger was announced. And the publication date was July 2017, which at the time seemed like a little while away for me, but the publishers were saying, you know, this is a really short amount of time. And I was lucky that I think I'd revised the manuscript so many times. Like, it didn't need a structural edit, really, at that point. It was more of a line edit.
And did you enjoy that process?
I loved it. It was great. It was really, getting someone to sort of look at your work so forensically and just dive so deeply into it. I mean, you'd know what it's like.
It's a bit overwhelming, isn't it, that the focus, the concentration they have on your words.
Yeah, yeah. And even down, like the improving the expression and rhythm and those sort of things was great. And it just the editor's ability to see things, which I, you know, having read it and reworked it so many times, I thought I'd seen everything in this manuscript, but she still found things which were enhanced it so much into the final form. But even little things like just some of those details and consistencies. And I remember in the book, the boys kind of covet and desire Nike Air Maxes, but they were, and I don't think I've said this anywhere, I don't know if I should tell this story
or
not.
Go on, tell it.
Well, they were originally Reebok pumps, and because I loved Reebok pumps.
Yeah, didn't everyone of that era?
They were the coolest thing, and I remember there was like one kid at school who had Reebok pumps, and everyone just thought he was like God, you know.
Followed him around.
And so I originally had them as Reebok pumps, and when going through the editing process, I said, we've looked at this and, you know, this is 1989 and there was a release of Reebok pumps, but that was probably 6 months afterwards in Australia. So, we just don't think it's going to work, and because then you have to shift the timeline, and that's not, you know, going to have consequences.
I love editors so much.
And it was just, that was probably, like, of the things in the manuscript, that was one of the things that I really felt, that I felt quite tortured about, which sounds really odd, but it was because I just had this really strong image of those pumps. But the Nike Maxes work quite well. Oh. But the other thing which I loved was there's a scene where Ben is in the lounge room with his mum and dad, and on the TV in the background is a game of cricket, One Day International. At the MCG, Dean Jones is in, Curtly Ambrose is bowling. And the editor, and I think it said something like Dean Jones was on 33, and so Viv Richards put Curtly Ambrose back on the bowl. And the editor said, we've looked back through like the cricket schedule at that time, and the West Indies did tour, but that was later in the year. It wasn't in the first half of the year, it was in the second half. We just don't think that's quite going to work. But there was a time where Dean Jones made it to 20-odd, so you could use that. And so I was like, this is a fictional story, and we've got a TV on in the background showing a fictional game of cricket and in a fictional scene, and it's not really instrumental to the story. But she was absolutely right, because she said, you know, you've got to make this world as real as you can, and anything that because you have cricket nuts who read,
and you lose them exactly. You lose them right there when you take them out of the story.
Anything that jars you out of the story and you go and you see the author's hand, that's what you're trying to avoid.
We love editors
I was so impressed.
So you said, you know, publication day seemed a long way away for you. What What was it like? Was it like you expected? Was there flowers, champagne, fireworks?
Look, I think I had that, which is not atypical. I had the kind of 2 weeks out apprehension of just thinking, oh my God, I don't want this to happen, and fear, and just wondering how are people going to respond to the book? Are they going to hate it? All those things. I don't know. It's really hard because I wanted it for so long, and I wanted it for so long, and I had the rejections, and I had all that, and I thought, you know, when this happens, it's going to be like magic. And it's great. It's wonderful, but it isn't. I don't know what I was expecting, and you expect some kind of like emancipation from these demons, you know, that have been torturing, but it doesn't really happen. And you kind of, it's wonderful. And, you know, the actual launch itself was, I was terrified of the launch, and I don't really like events where I'm the, like, I didn't have a 21st, I didn't have a 30th. Okay. I don't like sort of those
You're
events
not the party
where,
boy.
You know, and I don't like to be the center of attention like that. But it was just wonderful. And that really, to have a whole lot of people in a room sort of like celebrating the book was just the coolest thing. And that was great. But the actual idea of the book being out there and readers being able to get it, it took a while for me really to understand what that meant in a way.
And what was it? Did you know, when those first responses started coming from readers, how did they come to you? What were they? What did it feel like?
Yeah, I think probably the early ones were industry ones. So like Books and Publishing Magazine and then booksellers doing reviews. I think when they were positive, and that was great, but it's still like that negative self-talk is still there the whole time, and you're thinking, oh, they're just saying there's some other reason behind this. It can't be true. And I felt really lucky that they were positive and they continued to be positive, which was it was more of a relief, I have to say, than a kind of a joy. Like, you're always excited, but when the first reviews start coming in, I'm sure you know this experience, like you're scanning, like you're opening the paper on a Saturday, just maniacally going through, looking for your book. And when you see it, your heart just kind of stops and you end up, and it was actually quite similar when I look back on it now, to when my agent would forward through the responses from publishers, that I would just scan through in about 10 seconds looking for the key words. Yeah, like however, or but. And so, I was lucky that, you know, in the reviews that didn't happen. So I felt really, really fortunate. But then, with the readers themselves, when they started to contact me, and, you know, with the benefits and pitfalls of social media, people do. It was wonderful. It was weird, and I don't think I'd really thought about that phase, like that if people, which sounds ridiculous.
No, but I don't think no one really prepares you for it.
No, and it's a strange thing to have people come up to you and talk about their experience of this thing you created. And I think particularly because I was really conscious in the book of allowing some space for the reader to enter and a bit of white space there and for the reader to join the dots. So it's really fascinating to see what readers bring to it, and they have different kind of conceptions sometimes of what happened, or even links between certain aspects which I didn't even think about and or maybe existed in my subconscious. So that's really cool. It's really, really cool. But I still have the experience of, like, when I go into a bookshop and I see it there, I almost can't look at it. It's weird. It's sort of...
Could you read it again once it was...
I haven't. I haven't read it again, no. And I did pick up the audio book, and because I thought I should have a listen to it, and I think I got about 2 minutes in.
I couldn't do mine either. It's a different thing. I heard Keridwen Dobie recently talking about, you know, once the book is out of us, you've kind of birthed it or got rid of it. It's sometimes like a monster that's kind of come out of us, and then it's hard to go back to it again.
Yeah. And I think you do, like, occasionally when you're doing readings and things like that, you know, you're looking at bits of it and you have that moment of going, did I write that? It's just this out-of-body kind of experience, because the parts, and I suppose it does depend on how you write as well. And my process was, I tried to tap into the subconscious as much as I could in writing the novel. And so I think that maybe contributes to that that sense that, yeah, almost I was like a different person when I wrote that book. And because you move on and you move on to the next project, you definitely have a different relationship to the book. Like, I love it and I love the story, I love the characters, but it's kind of done for me, and it's this thing that's there and can't be changed, and I like it like that.
Which has another tension in it too, doesn't it? Because Wimmera has had extraordinary success in terms of its being longlisted for numerous awards and winning some, such as the Indie, in terms of you speaking and being at festivals. So you've had to continue on with having it quite present for you as well. Mm. How have you dealt with the success of it, in a way? I know, you know, writers talk about success all the time. Christos Tolkis talks about not expecting the greed that was in him after the success of The Slap for more of it, you know, or that Anne Lamott talks about it like a heroin hit, really, you know, that you just keep needing more. Did you have that experience, or how have you dealt with success?
Yeah, it's almost like there's two different things, I suppose. Like, there's many different things, but the awards are kind of a category of their own in some ways, because you never, like, you know, 12 months ago, 18 months ago, you never ever expect something like that's going to happen. But definitely, like, I can relate to that Christos Tolkis comment, because the goalposts move and all of a sudden you're no longer satisfied with being on a long list. You're thinking, oh, well, I hope I win, you know, and you kind of, there's a part of you that really becomes hungry for that success, because it's exciting, and, you know, that your publisher's happy, and, and you're getting that affirmation from industry, and that's wonderful. But the odd thing with that is, though, when you actually do win those things, it's a strangely, I'm kind of reluctant to use the word empty, but there is a kind of an emptiness about it, because you feel excited about it, but then it's done, and it's not like you're basking in it. I certainly don't. Someone asked me about this the other day. I said, "Oh, you, with the success, you're just sitting around sort of basking in the glory of it?" It's like, no, it's not like that at all. It's kind of, it's nice, and it's really nice to get that, but I don't think it's not unlike the publication itself. You think that it's something you really want, but once you get it, it doesn't really change anything. And it changes, I suppose, that you can reach more readers, and that's the best thing about it, because more people will take notice of your book. But it doesn't, I hope it hasn't shifted who I am in relation to my work. I don't think it has, because it's still, for me, very much about that process of, you know, going up into my loft and just sitting there, you know, with nothing else going on, just with silence and working. And that's what I love about writing. It isn't the accolades so much, which sounds really easy to say, because I know there is that part of me that likes that.
Of course, but I think it is hard too. Have you been able to keep that space, that silent space in your loft, as a similar kind of writing space or a similar feeling to what you had before any of this? Or has there been changes that you've just had to incorporate?
I think the most practical change has just been events and doing speaking engagements and things like that. So, which are wonderful, and to be out there talking to readers is great, but that does take a fair bit of energy to go out there and do that. And it is just so different than the actual day to day of writing. It's the opposite. And so I find that I need, it's not just the time for the events themselves, it's actually time around it to kind of recover.
Yeah,
in a
decompress
sense.
Or something.
Yeah, yeah. And so it does become tougher to guard that writing time. And I'm probably not that good at it because I do find it hard to say no to things because, and I think that is a little bit of a, I don't want to say it's a pitfall for new writers, but you tend to say yes to everything because you don't know what's going to come next. And you think, if I say no to this,
no one will like me. No one will ever ask me again.
Exactly. And so that's a real, it's kind of, you've got to get past that a little bit because ultimately what you're, what you should care about is your work. And you do have to balance it. You do have to be out there. And that's been part of the success of the book. It has enabled me to be out there talking about it. But it's a tricky thing because people want, I wouldn't say that you become, wouldn't go as far to say that you become part of the product, but it's there is a little bit of an expectation nowadays that you, and I don't know if it's partly because of social media as well, and that you have that presence and that you are out there talking about the book.
And available both on social media, but that you make your life available, that the stories of behind the book, who you are, that you're available to readers. And people have talked, and we've talked to writers as well, who've said that that's a real tension between that, the author brand that they're putting out there and that reclusive person who wants to be at home with their cat on their knee typing out the next manuscript as well.
Yeah. And I think that and partly I do feel like there's there's many sides to every person, but there is that side of me which is like can kind of switch on and go out and do those things. But that is a very different part of me than the actual writer, and I like when I'm working, I bought like earmuffs from Aldi, I like a complete sensory deprivation.
Yeah, wow.
Just I don't want a view, I don't want anything nice around me, I just want the work and that's it, that's all I care about. So kind of the I wouldn't go as far to say the glamour, but the kind of events and things like that, it's so far away from where I'm at when I'm working.
Were there other obstacles, other things that you found really difficult in that first part of publication, after that first release into the wild?
I think it's, I don't know, I'm a bit of a fatalist in some ways. So which is probably, helpful in some respects in publishing because I did like there's a lot you don't know and you sort of rely on your publisher kind of to run things for you and I didn't ask a lot of questions and I sort of would just wait to be told things a lot of the time and it's partly still that relationship and I think partly kind of a hangover from the rejections that I had that you have this fear that it's all going to fall apart at some point and it's kind of ludicrous. I remember I had to go up to Sydney. It was soon after I'd signed the deal and I had to go up to Sydney. It was a pre-Christmas Hachette conference where they had all their account managers there from around Australia. And I had to present on my book. And I actually hadn't met anyone from Hachette at that point. And I went up there and there was kind of like 150 people in a room up in this building in the middle of Sydney. And I was terrified. And I really thought that if I did a bad job, That like
the
contract, and like my agent said to me, "What did you think was going to happen? Like that the publishers would just stand there with your contract and just tear it up of your eyes?
Fear.
Like it was just that fear." And I wish in some ways I had. Looking back on it now, I do wish I had have asked more questions along the way, just to give myself a bit more assurance. Like everything's fine, and your publisher does have your best interests at heart always. I think, well, that's been my experience at least, and I've trusted in them a lot. But I probably could have given myself a little bit of an easier time if I had have asked for info here and there, because yeah, my own. Imagination again would run wild and go into dark places, I think, at various stages.
That's really good. That's really good advice, I think, to someone to say, you know, you can ask questions. I know Claire Coleman, who we spoke to, said, you know, the publisher's on your side. Like there's a whole team of people who want you and your book to do really well. Yeah. So do kind of ask those questions. Mm. Mark, obviously Catherine's about to kind of embark on this whole new world. For her and for other writers who are about to publish, what kind of advice can you give them about navigating the first time?
Just trying to think of what my like top tip would be. I think like preparation, that sounds really boring, but actually preparing yourself in terms of like when you do have to do interviews or public appearances. And I know and perhaps it's different for different people. Some people can wing things. I'm the kind of person who needs to know that if everything fell in a heap, I could still get through it.
Yeah.
And I think just giving yourself enough space before those events to prepare, to feel confident, to be calm and relaxed, and just have that, you know, a little bit what, like Claire said, I suppose that trust that the people involved in putting your book out in the world, they want you to succeed, and they've put so much energy into getting you to that point, and to have faith in them as well. And I think that, you know, it's such a rare moment to be published, and particularly that first time, it's a magical thing. And I was talking, I think it was, it's going to sound like it's not probably a piece of advice, but I really liked this. I think it was Mark Smith who actually said it, that at your launch, to kind of go away, like from the front of the room, stand back and look out over the people who are there and your book and everything else going on, because it's just such a unique moment and you don't fully appreciate it when you're in it. So just to step outside of things sometimes and really value it. And I even the reviews, you know, the good things that happen, to stop and celebrate them, because I'm not the sort of person who naturally does that. But I've learned along the way that it's a really good thing to mark events and make something of it, because we're in a really fortunate position in a pretty brutal industry. So, I think it's almost incumbent upon you to enjoy it in some way. There's things you complain about from time to time, or that can be a bit of a drag or whatever. But I always, you know, counter that thought with, you know, there's so many great authors out there who've written manuscripts that never saw the light of day. And for me to be sort of complaining about things just seems really churlish. And yeah, there's some things that will knock you from time to time. But in the scheme of things, I would like not trade my situation for the guy who was sitting there kind of like, I loved the process of writing before I was published, and that sustained me. But to be where I am now compared to where I was then, it's just a completely different world.
Mark Brandy, can you recommend a debut book for us?
Yeah, I read one recently, actually, which I just thoroughly enjoyed. It was And it's going to be out in August, I think. It's called Scrublands by Chris Hammer. And so it's a debut novel. He has published before, but a non-fiction book. And it's kind of odd because before I published my book, I wasn't kind of steeped in crime fiction at all. But since being published, I've been sent a lot of crime books. And this one just stood kind of head and shoulders above the others. It's something I think it'll be massive. And it's just just to give a kind of a brief summary of the plot, the opening scene essentially is a priest in a small town who goes out onto the steps of his church and opens fire on the congregation and then he's shot himself. And it's really about this journalist who is kind of struggling a little bit from Sydney, and he's sent to this small town a year after the event to kind of do one of those anniversary type stories, which we're all probably familiar with. And just the way Chris Hammer renders this town and the characters is something pretty special and almost poetic in parts. And he's a beautiful writer, a beautiful observer. And his background was in journalism as well. He's just, and I really read for character. It's got like a ripping plot, like the plot's great, but the character is what sustains me through a book. And he is absolutely pitch perfect with these characters and how distinct they are without ever being cheesy. And one of the things I love too is like through the course, because an investigation occurs and kind of, yeah, the plot becomes quite complex, but you have a police investigation and sort of the journalist side of things as well, where the nation's media descends on this town. And it's a great exploration, which I've never read before, of how really the media operates, and this kind of insider's view of just, like, we talk about publishing being brutal, like print media or even just TV media, radio is a really, really tough industry. And it's a great, if you just read it purely on those terms, it's a great read. But yeah, no, I think it was just a cracking book. I loved it.
Fantastic. Thank you, Mark.
Thanks, Kate.
To find out more about Mark and his work, go to our show notes where you can find a link to his website and to lots of other things that we talked about in that episode. And let us know how you are finding the podcast. Get in touch on Twitter or via the website and let us know about your first time or questions you'd like us to ask our guests. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast, a podcast about the first time you publish a book. We recorded this episode at RMIT University on the traditional land of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. This podcast is produced by Phoebe Adie and Harry Morris. The First Time Podcast is created with the support of Writers Victoria, ACT Writers Centre and RMIT School of Media and Communication.